If you have followed me on Instagram, you know the love affair that I have had with the monarch butterfly over the last couple of years. I was literally a monarch butterfly for Halloween this year. That's how much I love them. Since I moved to Florida, I got really into planting milkweed and watching them hatch and just seeing this incredible life cycle up close. And it was so interesting because monarchs are something that we learn about early in school. But as an adult, as a, you know, 35 or 36 year old, when I was watching this life cycle happen up in front of my eyes, I found myself really needing to refresh on the miraculous thing that the monarch life cycle is and how important our role as gardeners is for supporting the monarch population as it is slowly on the decline. So I welcome back naturalist David Mizajewski today, who is a fellow monarch nerd. And we talk about why the butterflies are disappearing, but more importantly, how we can help restore their habitat and also just like how magical monarchs are. Like, this episode is just so fun. I highly recommend growing milkweed in your garden this year just to be blown away the way I was. If you have kids in your life, it's great, but I don't have kids, plant friends. I was just loving watching these monarchs grow and watching the chrysalis and watching the transformation. It was so joyful and awe-filled. And as we try and explore awe and ease and whimsy in our gardens this year, monarchs are a great way to do so. So I am so excited to bring this conversation to you today. Let's dive in.
Welcome to the Growing Joy with Plants podcast, where we not only learn how to care for plants successfully, but how to simply and affordably use our plant babies to cultivate more joy in our lives by doing so. I'm Maria, former plant killer turned happy plant lady, author of Growing Joy, The Plant Lover's Guide to Cultivating Happiness, speaker, podcaster, and most importantly, your new best plant friend. On Growing Joy with Plants, you'll find conversations about houseplant care, gardening tutorials, and wellness through the lens of plants.
Hi, plant friends. I'm Maria. If you're new here, welcome. I'm here to help you care for plants and grow joy by doing so. And sometimes growing joy in your garden has nothing to do with the plants. It actually has to do with the results of the environment that you create. And this episode is a great example of that because we grow a garden and we attract monarchs. And then we get to benefit from monarchs or birds or other creatures that bring us so much joy because of our gardens that we have. So anyway, hello, nice to meet you if you're new here. And if you're a repeat listener, welcome home. So happy to have you. This is such a fun conversation. And also, once again, I have been sharing my monarch journey on social media up close and personal in my stories and in short form video a lot. It's taken me a while to get an expert and make a full long form video on this, but the passion for monarchs has been living on my social media for a long time. So if you don't follow me already over on Instagram or TikTok or whatever social media you use, I'm Growing Joy with Maria across all channels. So check me out. I'm also in the midst of a home renovation right now. I'm pregnant. So we've got a lot of fun content coming out on the socials that I invite you to follow. But without further ado, this was such a fun deep dive with David. Whenever he comes on the podcast, I'm like, oh, I wish I had 2 hours with you because I want to nerd out even more. He's such a nerd. I love him so much. I want to have him back immediately. Let's nerd out about monarchs together. Here we go. David, one of my favorite naturalists. I'm so excited to have you back.
Hey, Maria. I'm so glad to be here.
When we had our last talk, when you were here for Leave the Leaves in October, I remember being like, wait, could you talk to me about monarchs? Because I've had such a monarch journey this year. I was a monarch for Halloween, David.
Amazing. I need to see pics of that.
I will. We'll make sure that there are pics in the blog for this episode. I'm sure I'll post them on Instagram too. But monarchs have changed my life this year. It's been the most joyful, connecting with monarchs has been the most joyful experience, but it's so fascinating. So I don't know, do you have like childhood memories or like any interesting connections to monarchs that you would want to share?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's coolest about monarchs is that they are one of the first insects that we learn as kids. You know, mm-hmm. I think it's probably bees and maybe ladybugs, right? But because monarchs are relatively large as butterflies go, they're certainly colorful with that sort of bright, deep orange color and the black veining on the wings and the white speckles on their bodies. They're just very, they're iconic in that.
They are iconic.
I think that, you know, any wildlife species that we kind of learn about and, you know, honestly learn to love as children, you know, has a leg up in the world because, you know, we grow up with these kind of emotional connections to the monarch butterflies. And I think that helps us when we have to ask people to get involved in saving the species and conserving the species, which I know we're going to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting that you started there because literally just before we hopped on here to record, I was responding to an email from a colleague asking for some input on how to talk about the value of monarch butterflies to folks that might not sort of intuitively sort of get it, right? And they were specifically asking, you know, it was a partner who had reached out to us and said, look, I'm trying to convince my community to do some things to save monarchs.
Mm-hmm.
What are my selling points here? What can I tell people? And, you know, usually the question circles back around to like, what's the benefit of monarchs, right? Like, and usually the sort of unsaid part of that is to me, to humans, how are these going to make my life better, right? And, you know, for some pollinators, we can say, well, they're pollinating our crops. So like the food you eat is literally coming from this animal. Butterflies aren't crop pollinators, including monarchs. Like, you know, we don't have that in our sort of arsenal of reasons why we should save monarchs and protect them. So really for me, it goes back to your question is why, what are the benefits of monarchs? Why should we bother saving them? Well, you know, they do fit into the bigger ecosystem. They are pollinators. They're pollinating wild plants, which are the base of the food web that supports us all. But that's a little bit amorphous. For me, what I usually give as an answer to that question is monarchs are important because they inspire wonder. Mm-hmm. They make our hearts happy. They are beautiful, right? They engage in some incredible migratory behaviors that will blow your mind when you really kind of learn a little bit more about them. And there's value in that to me, you know, value to humanity, to live in a world where there's wonder in nature that we can see and we can enjoy. It uplifts our spirits. It inspires us. You know, it's kind of like art too. You know, the value of art is often, you know, it's hard to pinpoint, right? But like when we don't have it, life is much less rich, right? And it's kind of the same with nature. Setting aside like the very, how is this going to benefit me? Like, what is the direct one-to-one between saving monarchs and my life? You know, no, there aren't medicines that are coming from monarchs. They're not pollinating our food crops, but they do bring us joy. And they do bring us the knowledge that nature's working. And when nature's working, that's a good thing. It's good for us, you know, mentally, emotionally, but also, you know, when nature is working, we know that we're actually going to be okay too. And when it's not, when species start disappearing, you know, it's the canary in the coal mine sort of analogy there. That's a warning sign that things are not good and that we could be affected too. So anyway, I know I just dove right into all of that, but your question couldn't have teed up what was already in my mind coming into this podcast.
Yeah, it's so interesting, particularly also you mentioning like they're a foundation of our education, our childhood education. It's taught in schools, right? So if they disappear, like that is a huge way that we, you know, when you're in your first grade class or whatever, and you end up hatching chrysalises for the first time, like that is a huge way as kids we connect to insects and butterflies and more than human beings, you know, and if they disappear, that's an issue. So are they disappearing? I feel like there's some like speculation of like, are monarchs really disappearing? Do they really need to be saved? Like, what is the current status of monarchs these days?
Yeah, great question. And I'm here to unpack all of this, because you're right. It gets complicated. You know, who work in wildlife conservation, you know, we're science-based and we're policy-focused oftentimes. And those two things are very wonky. And there's a lot of layers and a lot of complexity. And, you know, unfortunately for the average person, sometimes you get seemingly conflicted messages and it gets confusing. So my job as a naturalist and a conservationist is to interpret all of that for everybody out there listening. So hopefully I'm going to do a good job at that today. So bottom line is that yes, monarch butterflies are in serious trouble. They are rapidly disappearing. So that's the too long didn't read version of this. To unpack it further, here in North America, the monarch species that we have is what's known as the migratory subspecies. And this means that these are monarch butterflies that migrate. Pretty much all the monarchs that we have in the US and Canada and Mexico are part of this migratory subspecies, even populations that don't actually migrate. Okay. But that's important because when it comes to like, are these endangered? And I'm doing air quotes for anybody just listening and not watching, right? Because those definitions matter and those populations and subspecies and whatever. There are monarchs in the Caribbean. There is a different species of monarch that lives down in South America. There are monarchs in places like Southeast Asia, and there are populations in Europe that are almost certainly the result of introductions from humans, either recent or historical, alongside the introduction of their caterpillar host plant, the milkweeds. But we won't necessarily get into that just yet. So anyway, the main point is that the majority of the monarchs on the planet are found here in North America. They are Danaus plexippus, the migratory subspecies. Okay. And that is the group of monarchs, the type of monarch that is rapidly disappearing. So some of the confusion about are they endangered, are they not endangered, comes from there's a few different ways that species get designated as endangered. And of course, they're completely separate and their definitions of the terms are totally different. So there's the IUCN, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, which is an international body. They have a whole category ranking system. And a few years ago, they did declare the monarch butterfly as an endangered species under their sort of listing. But that doesn't have any kind of legal ramifications because it's just it's more informational, right? Now, countries okay. could choose to use that and then make laws in their country. The U.S. did not do that. So here in the U.S., we have the Fish and Wildlife Service, which oversees the Endangered Species Act, which is the agency and the law that designates endangered, threatened. And again, our definitions of endangered and threatened are different than the IUCN's. You see how it gets very confusing. So let's back up. Yeah, that's
really confusing.
Right. Monarch butterfly populations, we know, are rapidly disappearing. Everybody agrees on that. And in fact, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service did do a scientific assessment a few years ago and did conclude that listing and protecting the species under the Endangered Species Act was warranted, but precluded, and that's a legal term, because there were too many other species in line in front of it. And this is one of the challenges we have getting protections for species, because a lot of them are in trouble and it takes a lot of time and money and politics to get them the protections. And so there's a bunch of other species that Fish and Wildlife said, well, we got to work through them first before we can get to monarchs. We'll make an announcement decision by the end of 2025. Well, that came and went. And they have not made a decision. They've sort of punted the deadline. Hopefully by the end of this year, we'll know for sure. And that will determine from a legal point of view, whether or not monarch butterflies we can give them the term endangered, or what Fish and Wildlife is proposing is listing them as threatened, which is one layer down in terms of urgency from endangered, according to the Endangered Species Act. So
and what about you're mentioning from a legal point of view? So what does that mean? So if they do get this endangered, not certification, but like level, legally, what can be done?
So what that means is that we can actually devote resources, money, and make it priorities in, say, state wildlife action plans and federal level that like we need to do certain things to protect them. It could, you know, it could result like, for example, with the bald eagle. Now, our nation's symbol almost went extinct, and that was largely due to the use of pesticides like DDT, which are insecticides, and we put them everywhere all across this country and all of our farmland, not knowing that those build up in the ecosystem. So they kill the bugs, but they get into the soil, they wash into the water, they get into all the animals that the bald eagles were eating. Bald eagles are largely fish eagles, and they eat carrion as well. So these poisons build up in little amounts in the bodies of all the animals out there, including us. And if you're a predator, you eat all of those little animals or smaller animals that have toxins in them, and your toxin levels get much higher. And so what DDT did, it made eggshells in birds that ate a lot of fish. So things like pelicans and bald eagles, both of which plummeted because their eggshells were so brittle and soft as a result of DDT that they cracked. And so therefore, their reproduction went way down. Whoa. And the species plummeted. Because we were able to designate and list the bald eagle as an endangered species and the brown pelican, too, under the Endangered Species Act, that allowed us to do things like ban DDT because we were legally obligated as a country because we gave them the official designation. That would not have happened without that law and without those legal definitions and This is 99% of what conservation is working through all of this. It's incredibly complex and why we can't always win, because politics is involved. And money, it takes money to save species, especially when they get to the brink. And there's always competition for that, you know, politically. Oh, if the monarch butterfly gets listed as a threatened species, again, it just opens up a lot more resources and a lot more priority placed on doing the things we need to do to restore habitat, to minimize pesticides, which is a huge problem for the monarchs, to put funding into restoring their habitat, planting more native plants, notably native milkweed, which is what they need, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So hopefully that makes sense.
See, I've been really intentional about what I'm putting in my body, particularly when it comes to sugars and dyes and all the weird stuff that we find in packaged food. And I am so thankful that I have had Manucora Manuka honey in my back pocket for years now as my go-to sweetener for coffees, yogurts, and sometimes just as a little snack on a spoon. You've heard me talk about Manucora honey on this podcast because I use it in my coffee to make my brown sugar shaken espresso dupe. It is this rich, creamy, caramel tasting honey. It's unlike any honey you've ever tasted. Even just by looking at it, you know it's like so much better than your you know, grocery store honey bear. But it's not only delicious, it's ethically produced by Manukora's master beekeepers in the remote forests of New Zealand. And it has bioactives in it that have three times more antioxidants and prebiotics than regular honey. And these help support your cells and gut. And all you need is one heaping teaspoon each morning to get the most out of those bioactives. So if you've been hearing these ads for a while, because you know I've been loving Manucora for years, and you've been curious, now is a great time to try it. Head to manucora.com/bloom to save up to 31% on your first purchase. Plus, you get $25 worth of free gifts with the starter kit. It comes with the MGO 850 plus Manuka honey jar. I've gone through so many of those. 5 honey travel sticks, which are amazing for vacations, a wooden spoon, and a guidebook. So check it out at Manukora, manukora.com/bloom to save 31% plus $25 worth of free gifts. No, that you explained that so beautifully. It makes me think so much about microplastics, just the way that you just described DDT and how it affected bald eagle eggs, and this now conversation with fertility and like why fertility is such an issue. And a lot of the arrows are pointing towards microplastics, and it's the same thing. It's like we're unknowingly consuming all of these. It's like that's a total, that has nothing to do with monarchs. I'm just putting connecting dots together.
Well, you know, who knows how microplastics in the environment?
Yeah, totally.
You know, like there are so many unanswered questions, so many questions that no one has even asked, right?
Yeah,
exactly. Maybe we'll find that, you know, the plants are sucking this up and it's getting into the flower nectar and it's, you know, I don't know, but.
I know. And sadly, it won't be our generation that will suffer from it. And, you know, the next generation will figure it out.
But to bring it back to our last point, this is another reason why devoting the energy and the effort to, you know, getting things designated officially becomes important, because that could then open up funding for scientific research.
Totally.
That looks into this question. Absent that, that might not happen. You know what I'm saying? So it's all connected.
So why are the monarchs disappearing? What are the factors contributing to this?
Yeah. So again, great question, right? Like you need to understand the reasons if we're going to address them so we can fix them, right? So with monarch butterflies, let's just take a step back, because to understand their decline, folks need to understand, you know, a little bit more about what these animals are. So number one, they're insects. Number two, they are butterflies, you know, the sort of group of insects that largely feed on flower nectar. Some species feed on other things like rotting fruit and liquefying animal dung and carrion. Not everybody knows that. Everybody thinks, oh, butterflies, pretty flowers. But meanwhile, there's a whole bunch of them that are eating these really gnarly, gross things. But they feed through a straw-like mouth part called a proboscis. So for the case of monarchs, in their adult life, you know, phase of life, they're drinking flower nectar. But because they are butterflies, they have a complete metamorphosis. So they hatch from an egg. So this is the butterfly life cycle that we learn about, you know, in kindergarten, first grade. They hatch from an egg into a little caterpillar. The caterpillar feeds on the leaves of plants. and it grows rapidly. It goes through what we call instars, five instars, where it grows. And, you know, insects, they have their hard parts on the outside, so they don't have a skeleton. They've got an exoskeleton. So their outer surface is sort of their tough exterior. And so as they grow, that does not grow with them. So they have to molt out of that, essentially. And that's the instars. You know, so as they eat, their bodies get bigger, their skin, their exoskeleton's too tight. They have to shed that. And they go through five of those as they grow. And then they go into, they pupate. So that means they form, in the case of the monarch butterfly, what we call a chrysalis. So that exoskeleton forms basically this very beautiful, hard, bean-like shell. It's seafoam green. It's got brilliant gold dots on it.
It's golden.
It's golden. It's
unreal.
Totally, right? It's like, so cool. look at a monarch chrysalis closely. And if that does not spark wonder in you, you're dead inside.
Oh, my God. And towards the end, you can see through it and you can see the wings developing.
Yes, totally. Yeah.
It's the coolest thing ever.
Totally. Well, and even cooler to me anyway, as a science nerd, is that inside that chrysalis, and little side note too, moths form their chrysalis and they will spin a cocoon around it. So technically, butterflies have a chrysalis. Moths have cocoons, and butterflies and moths are closely related. In fact, butterflies evolved from moths to take advantage of day blooming flowers and that kind of thing. But that's a whole other podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So they go through, you know, egg to caterpillar to chrysalis. And inside that chrysalis, so they start out as these caterpillars, right? These sort of worm-like things with little, you know, kind of antenna and the little suction cup feet. And most of their body basically kind of liquefies inside that chrysalis and then reforms itself into the shape of a butterfly. Like, holy wow.
What the heck? It turns into like this existential goo. Totally. That's what I feel. It's like, it just like gooifies itself and then is like, okay, I'll turn into this beautiful thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And so like, you know, I think like the central nervous system and everything that remains, but like most of it kind of, you know, sort of gooifies and then reforms itself. It's like a transformer from the 80s, you know, like the robots that change from cars into like, you know, robots.
It's the OG transformer. That's what
totally,
it is.
Right. Yeah. And then they hatch out of that chrysalis in their adult butterfly form. So, and then, you know, important to note and emphasize is that they have completely different habitat needs and food requirements in the larval phase, the caterpillar phase, and the butterfly phase. So like I mentioned, the adult monarchs, they are drinking flower nectar. The caterpillars, of course, don't drink nectar. Caterpillars eat the leaves of plants. And this is another incredibly fascinating marvel of nature. So plants generally don't like to get eaten by animals.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to have their whole, you know, their whole bodies consumed or their leaves, which they're using to photosynthesize. That's how the plants make food. So plants have evolved chemical defenses. So most plants have some toxins in them,
mm-hmm.
which a lot of people, you know, I think don't know or they find very fascinating, including plants that we eat. You know, in fact, some of like, you know, antioxidants in plants are actually designed to like poison insects.
Mm-hmm.
And when we eat them in the doses that we get them from the plant, it actually helps our own bodies, you know, ward off pathogens and whatnot, right? And so, but most plants have some toxins in them, some more than others. Mm-hmm. So with butterflies and moths, you know, they're eating the leaves of the plants. The plants evolve, you know, these chemicals to keep insects from eating them. Most of the, you know, the butterfly and moth larvae would have died off. Those that survived had a natural immunity to it, and so on and so forth over millennia. And that's the process of evolution. And co-evolution is actually the better term for it. So what ends up happening is that the caterpillars have an immunity to some of these toxins. Now, they can't be immune to every plant toxin out there. So what they have done is specialized. And this is sort of a term in biology that talks about animals that, you know, they give up the ability to take advantage of a whole wide range of food sources and habitat types, and they just pick one and they get really good at it. And so that's what has happened through coevolution with butterflies and moths. They have evolved to feed on just a very specific, oftentimes very small number of plants that we call their caterpillar host plants. These are the only leaves that these caterpillars can eat. If they do not exist out in the landscape, then again, these animals can't complete their reproductive cycle and their populations go down. And that's the risk of being a specialist, because if the one thing you need suddenly disappears, then you're in big trouble. Whereas if you are generalists, that's the opposite. And you can take advantage of a lot of different resources. Like us humans, we're generalists. That's why we're so successful. We can pretty much eat anything. We can live anywhere, that kind of thing. So coming back to your question, why are monarchs disappearing? Two things. Number one, they're insects and they are susceptible to insecticides, right? And so we spray a lot of insecticides, largely in agricultural lands, but also in our home landscapes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's certain utility, obviously, in, you know, for crop production and whatever. The home landscape, I think, is a little bit harder to defend because in most cases, you can get away without spraying toxic broad spectrum insecticides. And broad spectrum means they are not specialized. There are some pesticides that will be very targeted towards a group of insects or other invertebrates, but then most of them will kill anything. Right. And those are the ones that we tend to use. And so we're spraying a lot of pesticides. And there's a lot of complexity here. So, you know, we've developed GMO crops that are resistant to some herbicides, for example, and which is great. It allows farmers to spray more of these on their croplands. There's less competition with weeds. We get better produce, right? There's no health implications of eating the GMO crops. That's a whole other thing, too. But so what ends up happening is that where native plants like, you know, native wildflowers that are a nectar source for the adult butterflies, and notably the milkweed, used to grow along the borders of our farm fields or even within. We've gotten much better at eliminating, like getting down to like 0% of those, you know, where historically there was always some, right? And so as we have gobbled up a lot of key habitat for monarchs, our grassland ecosystems up sort of the central flyway of this country, which is a critically important migratory route for the monarchs, we've gobbled that up with a lot of our big industrial farming, where we're spraying more and more of these herbicides that are killing the plants that the monarchs need. We're also spraying in more insecticides that are actually killing the monarchs directly. And we're then double whammying it everywhere else in suburbia, you know, by, for example, hiring a company to come spray your yard for mosquitoes. What do you think they're spraying, right?
Right, insecticides.
They're spraying broad spectrum, typically pyrethroids, which are a synthetic version of a plant-based insecticide. But the key thing, it doesn't matter if it's plant-based, right? People think, oh, it's natural, it's organic, whatever, it's safe. No. You know, again, plants create poisons to kill. And so when we, you know, mimic the plants, you know, poison synthetically, they still kill. So pyrethrins and pyrethroids, the synthetic version, are broad spectrum insecticides. Any insect that comes in contact with it will die. So when you hire these companies to come, and I literally see it, in fact, we're getting to that season where pretty soon here, I'm going to be doing this sort of educational, inspirational podcast interview talking about why we need to save the monarch butterflies. And I will look out my window and five of my neighbors will have people spraying the pesticides that are killing the monarch and the bees and the ladybugs and all the other beneficial insects, right? So monarchs are disappearing because we're destroying their habitat. You know, we're taking away the natural air.
I mean, milkweed has the word weed in it. So people are, you know, it's probably getting also killed with a lot of weed killers too, right? And that the native plants that grow alongside the highway that get cut down.
So herbicides and insecticides, both of which are forms of pesticides, right? Mm-hmm. So we're destroying the habitat, right? The natural landscapes that has all
of these plants, the one plant that they can land on and feed off of, we're destroying that plant, and then also we're destroying the caterpillars.
Right. Well, the milkweed is specifically for the caterpillars. Milkweed is also a nectar plant, so the adults might nectar at it as well. Other pollinators will nectar at it. So the monarchs need lots of blooming native wildflowers and shrubs and things that the adults will get nectar at, but they also need the milkweed specifically for their caterpillars. So we're developing, putting roads and pavement and giant industrial farms over top of just the general habitat. So that's habitat destruction, right? Then we're nuking everything with pesticides. So that's the pesticide issue. And then, of course, as if that weren't bad enough, you throw in climate change, which, you know, is destabilizing weather patterns, causing unseasonable and more frequent incidences of extreme weather. And those things have really done a number on monarch populations as well. Like when you get a freak snowstorm in October while the monarchs are migrating, it could wipe out a bunch of them.
And they're tender little wings.
Totally. Yeah. They are insects, right? So if it freezes, they will die, which is why they migrate in the first place.
Right.
So that's why monarchs are disappearing. We've destroyed their habitat. We're spraying pesticides everywhere. We're getting rid of the plants they need to survive. And, you know, we're causing this, you know, sort of global climate change that is destabilizing weather patterns that's significantly harming them. So I know, let's just take a deep breath there because that's a lot.
Take a deep breath. Well, the positive side is as gardeners, we have an amazing opportunity to help reestablish their habitats and make sure that every garden on our block, or at least our gardens, has milkweed in it when they need. Now, we need to know which milkweed to plant, right? Because there's all sorts of different milkweeds and some are good and some are bad. So can you walk us through, you know, the gardeners listening to this and hearing you so passionately discuss this and say, okay, I'm going to make sure I have a monarch way station in my front yard. What are the right species to be planting?
Yeah. So that is the exact right answer, by the way, Maria. So thank you for just intuitively getting that. Because regardless of whether or not the monarch butterfly gets listed as a threatened species here in the US, like that would be incredible and it's necessary and we need that to happen. But regardless of whether it does or not, there's still tons that we on the individual level can be doing. And that is important, right?
Easy, you know, we might stuff. There's easy stuff we can do. It's so simple. Yeah.
Right. And think about it this way too. The other thing that I think is so incredible about monarchs is that they're wildlife. And yes, insects and butterflies are wildlife, right? It's not just the wolves and the bears and the eagles, right? They're wildlife that can live right alongside us. And that opens up these opportunities for individuals to take simple actions, everyday actions that can actually make a difference. If a lot of us do them, you know, if only I do this, it's not going to make a dent.
Yes.
But if you do it and our neighbors do it and our communities do it and it becomes a thing to do, like the cool hip trend, right? The plant a monarch garden, right? Then we have scale. And that scale is where we will see the potential benefit in bolstering the monarch population. So how do you create a monarch habitat garden? Well, just go back to the habitat requirements, right? So it starts with the life cycle, the very first phase where they're eating those caterpillars. So that is the milkweed, right? So you alluded to this. Milkweed, as we like to say, has a PR problem because it's got weed in the name. Mm-hmm. It's really hard.
A plant, yeah.
Well, that's the thing. Milkweed, number one, there's over 70 species of milkweed. The botanists are constantly quibbling. Is it 72 or 76? Oh, we just say over 70. There's a bunch of different subspecies. There are species that are found, you know, no matter where you live in the US, there in almost all places are at least one species of milkweed that is naturally found there, that's indigenous to the region, that's a native plant there. And those, of course, are the most ideal milkweeds for monarchs, because again, they're the ones that they co-evolved with. Most of our milkweeds are beautiful, ornamental wildflowers. Some of them have been in cultivation as such for a long time. You know, things like swamp milkweed, again, PR problem, right? Who wants to plant swamp milkweed? It's one of the most beautiful garden plants. It's got a beautiful smoky pink flower. It's got a delicate sort of sword-shaped leaf. It will grow in average garden soil, but it can tolerate moister soils, hence the name swamp milkweed. And its flowers smell like candy. Like a mild chocolate. It's just a wonderful, beautiful, functional plant in our gardens and wildly cultivated. It's Asclepias incarnata. That's its scientific name. Asclepias is the genus that all the milkweeds belong to. Yeah. So point is that milkweeds are not ugly by default just because there's weed in the name. Certainly some of them are less, you know, ornamental, maybe more nondescript, but there's plenty that are beautiful and they come in all sorts of different sizes, shapes, and colors. So, you know, you take something like a common milkweed, which is kind of robust. It's got these very big leaves, a big flower head, also sort of like a smoky pink. They're the ones that get the big giant seed pods that bust out in the fall and you see them in the meadows and everything.
Fluffy. Yeah.
Yeah, that's Asclepias syriaca. Then you get the swamp milkweed, which is much more sort of delicate and, you know, beautiful and refined. But then you can go to butterfly weed, which is the orange blooming, also super commonly cultivated. So bright orange flowers, a little bit more lower growing to the ground, a little bit more of a compact form, does really well in dry soils. So again, you've got a milkweed for all different garden scenarios. Then, you know, like if you live down in like Texas and into the desert Southwest, there's one called antelope horns. First of all, cool name. And like Google it. So it's got this very funky greenish white flower structure that is almost architectural. It's not what you wouldn't look at it and be like, oh, that's a flower necessarily. But it's freaking cool. There's green milkweed, which gets green flowers. There's purple milkweed, which gets this very rich, vibrant. The list goes on and on and on, right? So no matter where you live in this country, there's pretty much at least one, sometimes a dozen or more native milkweed plants, some of which are actively in cultivation by the garden industry. So more and more, you can go to your garden center and you can find some of these. More and more, there are native plant specialty nurseries that are out there, both in, you know, physical ones, but lots of mail order opportunities. And I want to give a shout out to the National Wildlife Federation, my organization. A few years ago, we spun off a for-profit business called Garden for Wildlife, Inc. Mm-hmm. And what that is, they're a native plant retailer online. And so it's curated, you know, sort of native plants that we helped pick to have the maximum benefit for monarch butterflies, pollinators, you know, like bees, hummingbirds, all those kinds of things. And so we've kind of done all the homework and all that kind of stuff. So all around the country, if you're new to this and you are not sure, you can always go to gardenforwildlife.com and get the Monarch Bundle. And we'll send you both the milkweed plants for your region and nectar plants for the adults.
Seedlings or seeds?
Seedlings. They'll be little. Okay. Yeah, exactly. So you can literally.
Sometimes I feel like people are like, just plant monarch seeds. But seeds are harder, especially when you're in the beginner phase. I don't know. I'm not in my seed era right now. I'm in my easy era. I didn't know that. Okay, say that name one more time.
So it's gardenforwildlife.com. And again, it's curated lines of native plants for your region that are going to have the maximum beneficial impact for the wildlife, the bees, butterflies, birds, that kind of thing, but also are not pesticide treated. So you know that you're not going to inadvertently be poisoning. And that is one challenge if you go to your local nursery, especially big box stores. Oftentimes, even those native plants that are marketed for pollinators have been treated with pesticides. And you might inadvertently be poisoning the very pollinators that you're trying to attract. So always ask, be an informed consumer, be a consumer advocate, use your voice and just say, like, I need to know that these plants were not treated specifically with what we call systemic insecticides. Mm-hmm. So you treat the seed and every part of the plant then becomes toxic, including the nectar and the pollen. They're called neonicotinoids. I know that's a mouthful, but ask. And if they can't answer that these were not treated, don't patronize that nursery. And keep asking. And the more of us that ask as consumers, then the industry will follow. That's just the way of the world, right? So we can advocate on the nonprofit side of things, on the policy side of things. But if consumers are asking for it, it's 10 times more effective than us nagging to get it done, right? So anyway, yeah, you can find milkweed. You can grow it from seed. Some of them are easy to grow from seed. But I agree, if you're a newbie.
Are there milkweeds to avoid? Like, are there some milkweeds that the monarchs don't like?
Yeah. So once we know we want to plant milkweeds, and it's like, what milkweed? So again, you can do some research. We also have something called the Native Plant Finder on National Wildlife Federation's website, which will give you a list of the top plants, again, for your zip code. And this is based on science too, by the way. It's not, we didn't just willy-nilly pick this up. We went into the literature with the help of Dr. Doug Tallamy, who's sort of famous in this area, if you are familiar with him. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we helped fund him and his team to put together this database based on zip code, based on the scientific literature to identify the top caterpillar host plants. And when you go there, you know, put in your zip code, you can look up your milkweed and it will list all of the native milkweeds to your region that you can then use as your shopping list when you go, you know, to local nurseries or you shop online, that kind of thing. So number one, plant the native milkweed to your region. And like any other garden situation, just practice good gardening, right? Like, don't plant swamp milkweed, even if it's native to your state or your region, in the middle of a super dry hilltop, because it doesn't, you know, butterfly weed will do well there, right? So just know, like, right plant, right place. Mm-hmm. You know, pick the milkweeds that are going to grow best in your conditions. What you want to avoid is planting non-native milkweeds. And there are some of those. And the big one is called tropical milkweed. Uh-huh. Asclepias curassavica is the scientific name. Now, unfortunately, this is one that's very easy to cultivate and has long been in cultivation. And in some places, it's the only milkweed you can find at the local, especially, again, big box store, big box nursery type place. Now, we have come to find out in, you know, recent years that tropical milkweed, though monarchs love it, they love to lay their eggs on it, is problematic. So tropical milkweed, I believe, is native to South America. So it doesn't, in most of the U.S., it's treated as an annual. So it will die back in the winter because it's not cold hardy the way that our native milkweeds are that grow in northern climates, where they go dormant and then they sprout again in the spring, right? So that will happen, or die off as an annual, depending on how far north you are. But in the southern range of the U.S., it doesn't die back. And what we have found is two things are happening. One, it's harboring pathogens that kill monarchs that our native milkweeds aren't to the degree because they die back. But by being constantly present, it becomes a place where these pathogens kind of build up. And then when the monarchs come to visit the plant, lay their eggs, they get infected, right? So that's a huge problem. And then the other thing that we are noticing is that as the monarchs are migrating south, and we haven't even really talked about the migration, but the eastern monarch population east of the Rockies migrate down to Mexico, to sort of central Mexico, to this one specific area up in the mountains in the state of Michoacán. It's been designated, it's called the Monarch Biosphere Reserve. And it's where all of these monarchs, sometimes, millions upon millions when the population is healthy.
That's amazing.
It's really incredible. I've got to go there and it's just still mind-blowing. But at any rate, what we're seeing is that the presence of this tropical milkweed in the volume that it is in places like Texas and Louisiana and those deep south southern tier states where the monarchs have to go through, a lot of them are stopping and they're just not finishing the migration. And so the migration itself is at risk because if monarchs just stop, then they're never going to continue down to that Monarch Biosphere Reserve. And this sort of natural wonder of the world could disappear.
Why are they stopping?
Because the milkweed's there. Yeah, because the milkweed is there. And they're like, oh, okay, well, I guess we can just stay here and lay eggs.
Interesting. Yeah, I got duped with the tropical milkweed because I live in South Florida. So I live in Zone 10B. So when I did a little native pollinator garden and I went to my local garden center, which normally leads me awesome, like in awesome directions, because my issue is I used to garden in zone 6B and now I'm in zone 10B. So I'm like totally disoriented with what to plant. So yeah. I went to the garden center. They had tropical milkweed, but I was like, well, I'm in the tropics. Like I'm in zone 10B. So like maybe you're not supposed to plant tropical milkweed up north where I used to live. But like if I'm in a tropical region, pretty much, maybe it's okay. And when the plant did grow back, so the first year was incredible. I mean, I brought the chrysalises in and I think we had four or five generations of monarchs that hatched and were fine. The following year, this is making sense because the monarchs definitely, I had one family, one generation that had that disease where their wings come out crippled, like freaky. And then I didn't realize that. Yeah, I totally got duped.
Yeah. So yeah, and unfortunately you learn the hard way. Yeah. So for anybody wondering, I just want to identify how you identify the tropical milkweed.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy. So number one, if you can remember the scientific name, and if it's actually on the plant tag, it's Sleepius curassavica is the name.
Okay.
So that's the one to avoid. But very important, it's the only milkweed that has a bloom that is a deep, deep orange, red orange, and
very
also
pretty.
Yellow. Yeah, it's very pretty. It's ornamental, right? And it's, again, easy to grow, all of that kind of stuff. It's like,
grew great
Mother
down
Nature.
Here.
Like, grew why are you making this? Like, help us out here.
Yeah.
Butterfly weed, the native milkweed, which is, by the way, one species that is found almost entirely across the country. Butterfly weed has an orange bloom, but it's just straight orange or yellow orange, and it's more compact. The leaves are a little bit lighter. The stems are fuzzy, if you really want to get into it. Tropical milkweed doesn't have the fuzzy stems. The leaves are, I think, a little bit darker, and the blooms are the red and yellow orange.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you want to look for. So yeah, so I mentioned earlier on that even though the monarchs that we have in the U.S. are the migratory subspecies, there are pockets of them that end up not fully migrating. So Florida is one place. Like there is a sort of an evergreen population of monarchs, especially as you get into South Florida. But then with the migration south, some of them kind of go down into Florida instead of cutting to the west and heading down towards Texas and down into Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of them, don't, I mean, there's always been some that don't complete the migration. But as you learned, it's still problematic to be planting the tropical milkweed
because it's totally perennial. It totally comes back.
Exactly.
It doesn't even die back. It totally just grows year round down here.
And that's why gardeners love it. And I get it. Yeah. I get it. And people buy it and it's good for the hort industry. One of the things
great. There's more leaves for the monarchs whenever they need, like it's available to them. But
and you know, sometimes this is, again, nature can be complex and there's layers of things that you have to think about. But again, that's why I appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk about this stuff and help people understand who maybe don't live and breathe it the way that I do every day. Mm-hmm. But I do want to actually circle back to another really, really important thing. And this is something that is a little bit difficult because people are very emotionally invested in it, but it's also very problematic. And that is hand-rearing monarchs.
Oh, fine, David. I'll stop doing it.
I'm sending you a big virtual hug. I am not coming for you, but I do.
You can read me. No, it's okay. Tell me I can't do it. It's for the good of the listener population. We all need to learn.
So really what it boils down to is that raising monarchs indoors, people do it because they care so much.
I raise them outside.
Well, taking them out of where they were outside, on their plant, anything you do to change that. Now, that's less bad than bringing them indoors. And I'll tell you why in a second. But again, people largely do it because they love these insects. They want to see them up close. They want to watch
it. They want to do it with their kids too. It's a big childhood activity.
Exactly. Yeah. There's there's no malice involved here, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people hear the news that monarchs are disappearing. And they're like, well, what if we all raise them indoors and release them, right?
And then set them free.
Right. So here's the thing. Mm-hmm. Is that unfortunately it's not helping. Mm. Number one, asking the average person to go out and capture wild animals out of nature and bring them into their house to raise them. And then think about that for any other species, right? Mm-hmm. It is not a viable conservation strategy. Mm-hmm. And that's in part because regular people aren't experts. They don't know the specific nutrition needs and light cycles and how to prevent pathogens and diets and, you know, the husbandry, right? Like sometimes that does happen in conservation, but it's incredibly complex, right? Yeah. So it's very difficult for, you know, untrained average people to do it the right way. And it's never going to happen at scale. You know, literally half of the US population would need to be doing this to generate enough monarchs that way to make a dent in the decline. Mm-hmm. That's never going to happen either. But even more to the point, and I think that this hopefully will help people who are really passionate about doing this, is knowing that all the research is showing that number one, hand-raised monarchs are much more likely to succumb to disease, mm-hmm. even if they don't die, and then spread it to the wild population. Mm-hmm. And number two, and this is where the indoor thing comes in, and it's still not fully understood, but monarchs that are raised indoors are weaker. They're weaker flyers, and they can't complete migration.
Right. Don't they get confused, like their direction gets thrown off? Yeah.
Exactly. And so this is one of those things, you know, like the microplastics. So you don't know what you don't know until you think to ask the question.
Well, it makes sense because they're not, especially if you're doing it indoors. Once again, South Florida, it's so hot all the time. I just brought them into my lanai, which is outdoors. It's just protected. But I was reading about this because it makes so much sense because monarchs don't get air conditioning. Monarchs don't get, you know, 60 to 69 degrees and like no humidity.
Right.
Particularly when they're migrating into more and more humid areas. So that makes total sense that if they're pupating and they're in the goo, but they're in air conditioning while they're in the goo, when they're supposed to be in like 80 degrees and humid when they're in the goo, that's going to mess them up. Yeah, totally.
Right. And they also, again, it's not fully understood how they do the migration, right? But and how they get from point A to point B, especially since it takes multiple generations. So the butterflies that hatch in the
summer. Can we talk about the migration real quick? I know we're kind of out of time, but
this
is crazy. It takes generations to have. I mean, it's literally poetry in motion. It's literally poetry. It's the craziest thing. It's so cool. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. So the gist of it is that, again, monarch butterflies, migratory subspecies in the U.S., broken between the eastern population, east of the Rockies, western population, west of the Rockies, same species, identical genetically, but they got this huge mountain range in between that is a barrier, right? So the eastern population migrates down to Mexico, as I mentioned, most of them, some of them end up in Florida. Mm-hmm. For the western population, they are migrating to the California coast, to the Southern California. And sort of a little bit more scattered, less dense numbers than in Mexico, where it's like just a few acres and there's like a dozen or so sites where they just really, really collect, and like so many monarchs that sometimes they break branches. It's crazy. So, but, you know, they're insects. So most insects, you know, they don't live very long. And the average monarch, you know, from egg to adult is only living, you know, maybe, you know, a couple months, right? Most monarchs only are in that butterfly adult phase for a couple of weeks, mm-hmm. right? And they mate, they lay eggs, and they die. That's their life cycle. But the generation that hatches at the end of the summer, because of the light cycles and, you know, the weather patterns, triggers in them to delay sexual maturation, and it triggers their instinct to migrate. And so they use the Earth's magnetic field, but they also use the position of the sun to be able to migrate down. So there are two places where having access to natural light and natural yep. weather are critical for the development and the migration. And if we take that away from them, what we're seeing is that those butterflies just don't live, right?
They get confused. It makes total right. sense.
So those monarchs, since they delay sexual maturation, and I'm sure there's some sort of lesson in here for humanity, they live a lot longer.
Mm.
So they fly all the way down to Mexico. They overwinter down there. They don't eat anything. If it warms up to over 60 degrees, they might take flight and drink a little bit of muddy water that pools up, called puddling. But for the most part, they just chill out. And then around this time, it's beginning right now, again, more light as the Earth shifts, right? The seasons get longer. That triggers them in warmer temperatures to begin the northward migration. So at that point, they do become sexually mature as they're beginning their northward migration. They mate and they get up into Texas, where the first sort of native milkweeds are growing and sprouting. They lay their eggs and they die. And then over the course of 4 to 5 generations, they go up that central pathway that I was mentioning, the migratory route, which, again, we have turned into the Corn Belt. So a lot of the native habitat is now in industrial farms. Mm-hmm. But they find what they can in terms of milkweed and nectar plants, and they sort of spread all the way up into southern Canada, and they start branching out eastward. So like where I am, I'm up in New Jersey. And before that, I was in DC. We didn't generally see monarchs until July, you know, late June into July, because it's like the third or fourth generation. And then again, the cycle repeats. Same thing happens in the West Coast population. They don't go through as many generations. And again, they're more scattered, but same general idea. But going back to hand rearing, people do it because they care. They want to see monarchs. They want to raise them with their kids and show them the life cycle. We can still do that. Plant a monarch garden. So yeah. We already went over that. Plant milkweed, plant lots of blooming, flowering plants through spring, summer, and fall. Mm-hmm. They need those blooming plants like asters and goldenrods and things like that to fuel their southward migration. So again, this is just good garden design, right? Plant yeah. something that blooms in all four seasons, plant both the nectar plants and the caterpillar host plants, and don't spray pesticides. If we all did that, we overnight would exponentially increase the habitat for monarch butterflies. And you could still go out and observe them, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to see them. If you plant the milkweed, you're going to see the caterpillars. You're going to see the adults. Not every caterpillar survives in nature, and that's okay. That's the other reason people collect them in. They're like, oh my gosh, I saw a wasp. Get one. You can't protect Mother Nature from itself, right? Some caterpillars
They lay so many eggs. Like once you have these milkweed plants, you're going to see even just watching the caterpillars grow and basically double in size like every 48 hours is so crazy.
They're little piggies.
And how they just like strip the plant. It's crazy how much they eat. But then also I found another interesting thing about it was they don't make their chrysalis on the milkweed plant. They're going to go somewhere else that's like a little sturdier. So you usually have to I used to look under my garden planter and, you know, sure. under like the eaves of my house, like close by to the plant. But normally, right, they don't normally put their chrysalis on the plant. Right.
Itself, they typically right? will crawl away from the host plant. And that's for any number of reasons, just to get away from all the activity, potential predators that are going to come in. You know, the milk monarchs are toxic because of the toxins in the milkweed.
Right.
That is what their coloration is all about. It is a warning sign.
Mm-hmm.
But it's mostly effective against vertebrates. So birds largely, but maybe mammals. Mm-hmm. Insects don't seem as much to be impacted by the nasty flavors that the caterpillars and the butterflies have. So things like wasps or, you know, mantises are going to take some of the caterpillars in particular, but the adult butterflies too. And again, I know it's hard to understand. It might seem counterintuitive, but that's normal, right? Us nuking them with pesticides is not normal, right? It's us taking normal. Away all of our habitat.
We're the problem. The wasp isn't the problem.
Right.
But I still feel like looking and hunting, you know, if you're doing this with your kids, or say you're, you know, a 37-year-old woman who just like really loves monarch butterflies and does everything she can. Yeah, like, I don't know, no one specific in mind. Caterpillars are really easy to see on the host plant. You know the host plant, where to go. You can watch them grow. You can watch them strip the plant. It's great. And then you get to go on a little chrysalis hunt, which is fun too, right?
Yes.
Like, so even if you're not putting them in your little container to really be able to watch it that up close, you can still definitely have an experience with a chrysalis. I mean, that's what I started doing once I figured out how I got by tropical milkweed and also by all of this stuff. And once you find where the chrysalis is, you can still go and enjoy looking at it up close and marveling at the gold, you know, specks on the chrysalis.
Right. That's like, again, it seems like, oh my gosh, I can't do this thing that I love doing that I thought was helping. And now this, you know, Debbie Downer environmentalist is telling me it's hurting. I can't do it. No, like you can just go out, like plant the habitat.
Yeah.
And this is really what it boils down to. And this goes for all wildlife. Wildlife need habitat, not a handout. Right. Mm-hmm. So let's give them their habitat. Let's give back their habitat that we got rid of.
That we ruined.
We planted lawn and put our houses on. You know, we can coexist. I mean, I'm not trying to make anybody feel guilty about living in their house. Right. Like we all need a home, too. Right. So but again, we all have we have incredible opportunity and choices that can support life or that just continue to banish it away into oblivion. I know what I want to do. I want to plant a landscape, a garden that is going to support the monarchs and bring in our native bees and all of the beautiful songbirds and hummingbirds. And, you know, I've got screech owls calling, you know, and I'm hoping I put up a nesting box. That's one area where you can sort of put something out to mimic a natural habitat feature, because I don't have any big dead trees in my yard that have a natural nesting cavity in it. That's one exception to the, you know, handout, I guess. But at any rate, you know what I'm saying? Like, we all have power here. And we can participate in a way that we can't for a lot of other declining species. You know, there's little you can do in your own yard that's going to save a polar bear, right? But you better bet that you can make very simple choices, very simple changes to the way that we do things. And it will have a huge impact, not only on monarch butterflies, but all the other incredibly cool butterflies out there, all the other moths that are super important pollinators and food for our songbird population. All of our beautiful native bees that are pollinating all the plants in nature and keeping the cycle going, right? And so on and so forth, right? Like when you help one wildlife species, you almost inevitably help a whole bunch of them because of ecosystems. Everybody is connected. So I want, you know, I know we're probably out of time here, but I think that's the big thing I want people to walk away from is that, you know,
even milkweed.
Say again?
I said, go get some milkweed. You have nothing to lose in your garden. If you're planting a garden this year, there's no reason why you can't plant one milkweed plant in it.
Totally.
You know what I mean? Like, just go do it. You're going to have so much fun.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I was going to say is the one thing to, you know, after you're listening to this, you might feel overwhelmed. You might feel like, oh gosh, I planted tropical milkweed. That's okay. You know, like live and learn, right? Now
we learn from our mistakes. We learn, we learn.
So go out this spring and plant a milkweed garden. Or I'm sorry, plant a monarch garden, which has to have milkweed and nectar plants. And like I said, just don't spray pesticides in it. That's it. Give up a 5-foot stretch of your lawn, right? Plant the milkweed that is going to grow where you live and let it go. And I guarantee you, this is my warning, my like warning label. It is addictive. You are going to do it. And these suckers are going to show up and you are going to see them. And then you're going to be like, oh my God, why do I have any lawn? I need to plant milkweed everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. And that is the beauty of this. It's, you know, you see the result and that's powerful. Again, going back to helping people understand and why are monarchs important, where we started the conversation, you know, in life, I don't know, I feel the older I get, any experience that makes my heart sing is something I want to protect and preserve and replicate, right? Mm-hmm. There's so much bad news in the world, right? Like, let's lean into the joy and helping brings us joy, right?
Totally.
And that to me is like, what's the benefit of monarchs? They're not giving us food. They're not giving us medicine, whatever. Like they're bringing me joy and that is valuable, right? So plant the milkweed garden or the monarch garden with the milkweed and then other native nectar plants. And I guarantee you the monarchs are going to show up.
We have the resources. I mean, I haven't heard about this gardenforwildlife.org. I'm definitely going to visit that because for me and my pain point of I don't know exactly what to grow, That's perfect that I can look at my region and zip code and just buy a pack of seedlings that you'll ship to me and I can just plant them.
Totally. It's super, super easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. The two websites are gardenforwildlife.com. That's the plant business, right? And then the other one is NWF as a National Wildlife Federation.org/garden. And you'll actually find a link to the gardenforwildlife.com there. Cool. So if you remember only one, nwf.org/garden, that is our native plant habitat, certified wildlife habitat website. So we haven't even talked about this, but when you create the Monarch Garden or any kind of wildlife habitat garden, you can register it with the National Wildlife Federation. And we call those certified wildlife habitats. You can put out a little yard sign, you get a certificate, and that is a great way of sort of joining the movement and becoming part of this bigger effort that lots
That's
of other people
so
are
fun.
Doing. And a lot of people like getting that recognition. I mean, look, the Monarchs can't read the yard sign, so it's not about that,
right.
But your neighbors can. And
exactly. And the kids, your neighborhood kids can.
Absolutely. It turns into an education opportunity. And I can say this, having worked in this program for decades at this point, I get the biggest charge as I travel the country and I see people putting out their NWF certified wildlife habitat signs. It's so cool to me because what it is another way of helping. When you get the yard sign and you put it out there, you are helping to educate your neighbors. It's literally the most grassroots way of sort of educating and advocating because the sign opens up discussions and conversations with neighbors and community members that I will never reach, mm-hmm. No matter how many interviews that I give, no matter how many talks in person. So it's really appreciated when people do decide after they create the habitat garden to get it certified with NWF because it does hugely help get the word out. And yes, we do sell the signs. We're a nonprofit. It's one way we raise money to do this work and fund me to come out and do this kind of thing. So full disclosure there. But at any rate, definitely, create the Monarch Garden first and foremost and then get it certified. And you'll sort of pay it forward even more when you do that.
Yeah, no, it's so fun. I just bought my first house and we're in a really lovely neighborhood. Little worried that there's an HOA. Little worried about it, but feel like I'm a very convincing person and I'll just go talk to the HOA and it'll be fine. But, we have so many kids on our block and in our neighborhood. And that's like one of the first things. I mean, I have to like renovate my whole house first, but before I do, and then I have to have a baby. And then maybe when I come out of my maternity leave, but that is gardening season. Like the fall would be planting season for us. But yeah, that's like one of the first things on my to-do list is to overhaul my front yard and try and get the neighborhood kids involved because it's so boring. Like with these HOA neighborhoods, it's all just little boxes.
Yeah.
So plants.
I won't go off on a total tangent about this, but we do have some resources at the National Wildlife Federation's nwf.org/garden that can help you design your wildlife habitat landscape in a way that will be less likely to attract the ire of an HOA.
Yeah.
But also tools that you might use to become engaged and maybe adapting those rules
totally.
To make
That's
accommodation.
My plan. Yeah.
So definitely we have something called cues of care. So in other words, how do I create this natural landscape that has cues built into it to the person walking by who's only ever seen a lawn that this is intentional? Mm-hmm. That it's not just a mess, that it's not weeds. And a lot of it is aesthetic, right? Like you have a choice in how you design the garden and what aesthetic you want. And, maybe you can't go for a full-blown wild meadow, right? A lot of people can't do that. And that's okay. I mean, yes, the wildlife will love that. But mm-hmm. if you plant the right things and you're not, again, doing the pesticides and other unsustainable practices, it can still be a very viable wildlife habitat within the parameters that you face. So another message there is you don't have to recreate everything in Mother Nature. It's okay to do what you can.
Mm.
Do your best. That's better, certainly, than not doing anything, right? So don't be intimidated or don't be feel like, oh, what I can do isn't enough. Even maybe you can only plant in containers. Maybe you don't even have your own yard or garden space, right? Like maybe you live
That's
in the city.
I've done this whole time. I have containers and I did one very large raised bed in my front yard and filled it with native pollinators.
Yeah.
And just had conversations with my neighbors. Like I didn't do a sign or anything like that, but there's totally ways you can do it. Well, maybe there's a Growing Joy NWF collab in the future about Maria's journey of overriding her HOA. That would be good content.
It would make incredible content. Sign me up. Yes, let's do that.
Well, thank you so much. You're one of my favorite people to have on because you're such a nerd, but you're such a great educator. And I'm so happy we got to shed light on one of these beautiful insects that bring both of us so much joy and hopefully will bring everybody listening joy this summer as you all plant your milkweed. I believe in all of you.
I do too. And I could not get a bigger compliment than being called a nerd and an educator in the same breath. That is what I'm here for. It is in my DNA. And I love
to find you. We're going to put all the links to all the links we discussed for NWF. But where can we also find you?
So both myself and National Wildlife Federation and Garden for Wildlife, by the way, we're on all the platforms. So Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, X, I'm on TikTok, although I'm not prolific there. YouTube, wherever your social media platform of choice is, you will find the National Wildlife Federation, me, naturalist David Mizajewski, and Garden for Wildlife. And if you can't spell my name, go to naturalist.nwf.org and all the links to my social media are there.
Yeah. We'll put your links in the show notes too. All right, David, your pleasure as per usual.
Well, I would love to come back. So let's think about our next topic.
For sure. Joy. All right, plant friends, if this episode inspired you, go find your native milkweed. Don't do what I did and buy the wrong one. Make sure you get the right milkweed. Skip the pesticides and notice what shows up and marvel. And please send me photos to my email, to my DMs. I want to see the monarchs that you attract to your garden, and let me know if any of you guys end up getting your garden registered with NWF, like we were talking about. I really want to do that once we move. We are moving and I am almost immediately having a baby, so I don't know if it's going to happen this summer, but eventually I will have a NWF sign in my front yard with the pollinators there. So fun. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. And of course, that you enjoyed David as much as I did. And the links for David and also the National Wildlife Federation are in the show notes. And I hope this episode and all episodes, of course, continue to help you keep growing joy. Plant friend, thank you for tuning in today. It means so much to me that I get to be part of your planty journey. If you like what you heard, make sure you're subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. We have so many incredible interviews and solo episodes on incredible houseplant and gardening topics that you will not want to miss this year. And while you're over there in the podcast player subscribing, why don't you click over to the review section of Growing Joy with Plants and leave us a review? Reviews are tremendously helpful for the growth of the podcast, so thanks in advance. If you're looking for more opportunities to grow as a plant parent with Growing Joy content, we've got so many options for you. First, I highly recommend you taking the Plant Parent Personality Test. It's free. It's super fun. It takes 3 minutes to complete. At the end of the test, you're going to get your plant parent personality profile and a curated list of plants, projects, and podcast episodes that are right up your alley, tailored just for you and your lifestyle, inspired by your results. The links are in the show notes. If you're looking to uplevel your plant parent game, I have so many free downloads on my website that I think could help you, like the Understanding Natural Light download or 9 different ways to green up your office space. If you'd like to support the show monetarily and help me bring the show to as many people as possible for free, you can head to our Patreon link in the show notes to learn more about our offerings. And finally, I invite you to come hang out with me and continue the planty conversation on social media on Instagram and TikTok. I'm Growing Joy with Maria. My DMs are always open if you have requests for topics or ideas for the show. Thank you again for listening. It is truly my honor and delight to help you keep blooming and keep growing joy.